Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Jesus Ramirez. Jesus is a graphic designer, educator, and public speaker. His clients include Adobe, Microsoft, Motorola, and Condé Nast, and many, 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 many more. His YouTube channel has over 2 million subscribers. As his career was hitting its zenith, he was speaking over in 30 conferences worldwide. He ended up with a stroke. It's quite a long shot story. It's remarkable. I'm really looking forward to sharing this with you. Here is Jesus Ramirez.
All right, I'm here with Jesus Ramirez. And you know, we were going to have Jesus on here and we're going to talk about skill set, new year, how can people like advertise their business, something a little bit more practical. But once again, I got to ask everybody, is there like a kind of underdog story? Like, you know, and he tells me this story we're going to get into. And I think it's quite impacting. But let's get into the origin a little bit. Tell us where you're from. Tell us where you grew up, a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. I grew up in Alameda, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I was born in Mexicali, Mexico, which is in the border with California. One of the interesting things about that is that my dad is actually from Alameda. He grew up in Alameda. So my dad and I actually went to the same high school, but he as an adult immigrated to Mexico, which is where I was born. And then when I was about 9 years old, brought his family, my mother, brother, and myself back to where he grew up. So my dad's first language is English, second language is Spanish. He's not an immigrant, but I am. My first language is Spanish, second language is English. So it's kind of a weird thing that, you know, my grandmother still lives in the home that they bought like in the 50s or something in Alameda, but me, I'm an immigrant. So it's kind of weird.
It's an interesting dynamic because it's like a little back and forth there.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that's where I'm from, Alameda, California. I love it. I still live in the Bay Area. I'm south of San Jose now, but I'm still in the Bay Area.
I know the area well. I lived in San Leandro for a year.
That's actually where my parents live now. Yeah.
It's a cool little town.
You'll know exactly where, right off the Marina exit.
The Marina. Yeah, that's where I live. I was like two blocks from there. My pit bulls would swim a little by the Blue Dolphin resort over there, whatever.
Yep. Great area.
So now let's get into, you know, high school. Were you a good student? I want to just know what built you, you know, like what were your grades like?
Well, terrible, but I don't know if we're going to get specifically into grades, but there were, you know, I was lucky if I was, you know, I don't remember, 2.5-ish, lower than 2.5 GPA average. Wasn't a very good student, not necessarily because I grew up we didn't have a lot of money growing up, and there were not a lot of positive influences that would guide me towards learning and appreciating the value of education. But in the back of my head, I kind of knew if I want to do something in this world, I got to learn how to do something. I didn't know what that was, but I wasn't sure if school was going to get me there. Now that I'm older, I see that school is very valuable, and I believe that people need to be educated, maybe not formally educated, but education is definitely very important. And I kind of started seeing that around me because I saw other successful people and, you know, nobody famous, just, you know, local, I don't know, dentists or like, you know, this guy owns a mechanic shop. He knows how to do something. So I knew that people that knew how to do something would probably do well in life. And
were you a good artist back then in high school?
I was relatively good, but not great. I've always told this story that growing up in the Bay Area, we have a lot of talented people here in all fields. And in my school, I could pick out 20 kids that were way better artists than me. At some point for about 2 years, we moved down to Southern California to the Coachella Valley area. And we live in Thermal, California. When I was in that school, I was the best artist in my school. So depending on what group you put me in, I was, you know, either a very good artist or just, you know, below average artist. But actually that helped a lot, I guess, because so living in the Bay Area, I was taking ESL, English as a second language classes, moving to Southern California with a primarily Hispanic population. My English was much better than almost everyone at that school. I went to a school where it was literally 99% Latino, and we had two white kids and one black kid, you know, and everybody else was Latino. So in that context, you know, I didn't need ESL. So they took me out of ESL. And then I came back to the Bay Area and no longer was in the ESL program. So it kind of helped going back a little bit. And when I mean back, I mean in terms of a lower skill set required to get to the next level. I probably would have stayed in ESL longer had I stayed in the Bay Area.
So we're going to get into the situation that happened later on, but that, you know, it's an interesting story here because you're going to find your skill set. You're going to find your cause celeb, your passion, your livelihood. You're going to excel at that. And then something else happens, you know, you think, right. Hey, look, man, I got my drive going. This is it. It's all smooth sailing, right? You know, what bad could happen? But how, help us understand your journey and how you segued into, you know, as I talked to Jesus, you know, he's got his YouTube reward, he's got a big YouTube channel. He's got, you know, he's great at what he does. He speaks a lot on, and we're going to get into the skill set after everything, but sure. I want to know, how did you segue into the success? How did you build that?
Well, I mean, it's a very long answer, but I'll try to keep it concise. So after I graduated high school, I knew that I needed to go to college. So I'll step back for a second. So when I was living in the Coachella Valley, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Michael, but there's a lot of dates, a lot of palm trees. So people pick dates. So I was about 16 years old and my uncle said something along the lines of like, hey, do you want to go make some money and go to work? And I was like, sure, you know, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, I'll make a couple bucks, sure. And I went date picking. And it
by Hadley's Date Farm in near Palm Springs?
Exactly. Yep. And I was like, God, this is, you know, God bless those people who do that type of work, but it's not for me. It's if you've never done it, you have no idea how difficult it is. It's backbreaking. Your eyes burn. I mean, I did it for 2 hours and that was enough for me. So at that point I realized, right, I got to learn how to do something, you know, like, I don't know what I'm going to learn how to do, but I got to learn how to do something. Cause I'm in the belief that if you know how to do something, you probably are going to do okay in life. And so that takes us to college. And I went to a community college first in a university, and I'm a soccer player. I like playing soccer. I remember that one of the reasons that I went to the community college that I went to is because I literally just walked on as a soccer player and made a team. So I started with them. Then I went to a university 2 years after that. And the university I ended up going to was the only university to reply my emails. I started emailing coaches and only got one response. And that's the university I went to, Cal State East Bay in Hayward, California. So I got to play soccer there, and that's why I went to that school. But once I was in school, I was like, all right, well, I gotta pick a major. What am I gonna major in? So I like computers and I like drawing. So graphic design, multimedia became my major. And that developed into an obsession of wanting to create graphics and to learn more about computers, and specifically Adobe Photoshop, which at the time, and it still is the standard when it comes to digital imaging, and just became obsessed with learning that tool. And after college, I had a couple of jobs, including I was a designer for Motorola. And then I started a small company with a couple of friends that, you know, just didn't go anywhere, but it taught me a lot of valuable lessons. It was probably one of the biggest failures when it comes to career business in my life, but it was filled with knowledge in terms of what not to do, which probably led to better decisions now. But the point that I'm trying to make is that I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. And then I answered a Craigslist ad for a marketing company, and it was like the biggest blessings in my life. I ended up working with this entrepreneur, copywriter. And I don't know if you're familiar with the old school Dan Kennedy, you know, type of marketing, long form sales letters and all that. Anyway, he was one of those guys. And I learned a lot about marketing. We worked at a marketing company that focused specifically on doctors of chiropractic. So we would create marketing content for them. So I learned a lot about creating communities, copywriting. I learned about, you know, obsessing over headlines to get somebody to open an email or, you know, open a physical letter. And most importantly, I worked with a self-made millionaire who taught me so much. I mean, I remember the first week in the job, he said, read these books. And he hands me The 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss and Crush It by Gary Vaynerchuk. And he just wanted me to have that mindset. Or if he would get on business calls, he would say, get on the phone, just don't say anything, just listen in. And I would just listen in. So I got to experience what a successful entrepreneur was like and how he thought. that even to this day, a lot of time, his name is Ben. A lot of times I'm like, what would Ben do? You know, like I would think, you know, I think about him and cause in my opinion, he's a brilliant business person. So he mentored me. He, you know, I don't know what he saw in me, but he definitely, took a lot of time and effort it's almost like, you know, like that saying, like you don't force a, what is it? Like you don't force a horse to drink water. You kind of like lead him. I don't know what the saying is, but the point is I felt he was leading me, but he never like pushed anything on me, but everything that he had to offer, I'm like, I'll take it, man. Like he would, he paid for a couple marketing conferences. I took any training I saw online that I would find valuable. He would just pay for it. And I would watch it. I ran all the Facebook ads on his company and I taught myself Facebook marketing through him. You know, I had a budget. It was about 40 grand a year on total on, you know, running Facebook ads. So all that stuff that I was learning about how businesses work, how marketing works, how building community works, building email lists, all that stuff was, you know, beginning to stay in the back of my head. And out of partly boredom, and by the way, something that I didn't mention is I got hired there as a web developer. So I also know how to code. I was doing a lot of coding in Motorola. So I wasn't doing that much graphics. I was doing more of web development. So that's what I got hired to do. But then he realized that pretty much anything he needed, my answer was, like, I'll figure it out. Like, just don't worry about it. I'll figure it out. Yeah. And that was our relationship for about 6 to 7 years. And during that time, out of part boredom, part like, I think I can do this, I thought, you know, I really like doing graphics. I really like creating, you know, just I'm a creator. So I decided to start my YouTube channel where I would show people how to create cool graphics, or at least something that I thought was cool. You know, maybe other people didn't think that. Yeah. And I started my YouTube channel and, you know, eventually I grew it to almost 2 million subscribers, but that was like a very long process. I did that while working with him for about 3 to 4 years. Once I saw that there was potential there as a business, I ended up quitting my job with Ben, and he actually doubled my salary. Offered to double my salary if I stayed, but my response to him is like, you wouldn't take that deal because, you know, you have that in you and now you put it in me. So I know that this is going to work if I work hard enough. And thankfully it has. I skipped over a lot, but that gave you like the abridged version.
Right. What year was this you started your YouTube channel?
2012. So it's been 10 years this year.
Okay.
July 2012.
Still kind of competitive there. It's not like, you know, the very beginning, right? So.
Right. Yeah. So I published more videos this year than probably my three first years combined.
Wow.
Just because not to say that I wasn't taking it seriously, but I mean, having a full-time job and then coming home and creating content is not easy. So it was a slow process. Could I have done it faster? Maybe, but it's all the time I had at that point.
Right. Now the YouTube channel, it can be a source of income, but really what the more, it's like a kind of like a podcast. It's like helps you with other things.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much you're making that much money off the YouTube channel, but you're making it indirectly. Correct?
So the short answer to that question is yes. I could probably, I mean, no, not probably, I could definitely live just off the money I make from my YouTube channel. It wouldn't be like a lavish lifestyle, you know, but my rent will be paid and my, you know, expenses will be paid and I'll be fine. It's definitely high enough now. It hasn't always been that way. And in my opinion, at least what I've seen in my YouTube channel and other people's YouTube channels, you really don't get to that point unless you have millions of followers. If you're under a million, it becomes a little more difficult. But once you get to millions of followers, then it becomes more feasible. And if I really wanted to, I could move to like Costa Rica or something and then just, you know, live like a king out there, only doing, you know, a couple of videos a week if I wanted to. But specifically, yes, you make more of your money in other ways, selling products, promoting products, you know, all kinds of different things.
So let's talk about that journey. What really pushed it? What moved the needle for you for growth? And what were some of the things that you did that really kind of pushed it and furthered you along? What are some of those milestones?
Well, success leaves clues, right? So I looked at other successful channels and what they were doing, and also look at the analytics on my YouTube channel. And to this day, I mean, I obsess over how can I get more people to click? How can I explain this better? I look at the graphs and see where people drop off. And all those little things are just clues. And you can go look at a video that is very successful, not just a video, like a channel that is very successful in your niche and see what they're doing. And not necessarily copy, but you can see like, oh, their interests are short. They get right into it in the first 10 seconds. They don't, you know, tell you about their cat and their, you know, weekend because they're here to see something else. So I went from having intros that were literally 2 minutes to, in this video, you're going to learn how to remove a background in Photoshop. Boom. You know, and instead of saying, hey, how you doing? My name is Jesus Ramirez. You can find me on Instagram at Jared from PTC. I hope you're all doing well. You know, like I'm already talking 30 seconds and people are like, you know, for my type of channel, people are there to learn how to do something. So I needed to get over that they don't really care about me. You know, at least that's the way that I see it. They're here because they want to remove a background from a photo. They're not here to find out about my weekend or any of that.
Right.
Now, if the video was titled vlog, you know, 13, my trip to Jamaica, then if that means that I can talk about my trip to Jamaica because that's why they're there. They clicked on the video for that reason. But, you know, so in my view, the type of content I create, they're there for a reason and I got to give it to them as best and as concise as possible. And, you know, I spend so much time on each video that you wouldn't believe. Like a friend of mine once told me, he's like, your job is so easy. Like you just published like a 10 minute video on YouTube and you do so well. And I was like, yeah, that 10 minute video probably took me a week, you know, to plan it, get the right graphics. Click through rate is very important when it comes to YouTube. So a lot of the times if I have an idea of like, yeah, I'm going to make a video on removing a background. Well, I'll literally design like 5 thumbnails and you know, like I will try to guess which of those would get most clicks based on how they look. And then I'll make a tutorial using that image as opposed to making a tutorial and then figuring out what the thumbnail is. I also think about, let me actually, before I move on, regarding thumbnails, I use a tool called TubeBuddy where it allows you to do A/B testing on the thumbnails. So if my click-through rate is not where I want it to be, then I'll do an A/B test on the thumbnail. Same thing with the titles. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm great at titles or great at thumbnails, but I do think about it a lot that it does make a difference. You know, I'm someone who believes that, you know, just tiny little changes could add up to a big change. So when my YouTube channel wasn't making any money, like zero money, I was paying someone to transcribe my videos. And I told someone about that and they were like, but why? And I was like, well, two reasons. Number one is I'm providing a service. It's a free service, but I'm still getting money in other ways or hoping to at that point. Mm-hmm. So it's a service. And I want my service to be better than anyone else's service. So for example, if you're someone who has a disability or English is not their first language, then they have the subtitles they can read. And that also helps me because YouTube looks at that content that you upload and then it uses it to find keywords within the content. Even now when YouTube automatically captions your videos, they don't use that for SEO. Only that's what they say, but I have different theories. We can get it. We can get more technical later if you want, but officially they only use the content that you upload. The point is that this person's like, but why are you, what's your ROI? And I was like, it doesn't matter what my ROI is. Like I want my stuff to be as good as it can be. And sure, could I have been just as successful not uploading it? Who knows? Probably. But the point is that I looked at that, at everything with that lens, right? How can I make this a little bit better? We were just talking about YouTube Buddy. I forget what the license is because I pay for the most expensive one, but I was paying for it when I wasn't making any money, you know? MailChimp, you know, like I was very fortunate to grow to a very large email list fairly quickly. So I was paying hundreds of dollars when I had friends who were trying to do the same thing. They were like, no, I don't even want to pay because at the time, I don't know about now, I think you would get 2,000 or 3,000 emails for free. And after that, they would charge you like $20 a month or something. They didn't want to pay the $20 a month. And I'm like, no, like you have to, if you want to get to a certain level, you can't be putting barriers and limits because then that's as high as you would go. And you can make the argument that I got lucky and that like, you know, it all worked out, but what if it didn't? And sure, that was a possibility. I'm not denying that. But the fact of the matter is, the more you put into it, the odds of succeeding are higher. Right. And I was just increasing my odds.
Right. Giving yourself higher probability because all these things you're doing. Plus you cared. You cared. You didn't want any weak links. You're like, look, I'm putting myself out here and this is the way it should be done. This is the best it can be from A to Z. And if P is at a place, I got to fix that. That's not right.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And because you cared about that, the product there and people liked it. So you're starting to hit your stride. You're like, holy shit, I can make money from doing this. You start doing, being successful with this, you know, then you start doing, you start getting speaking engagements from this thing. What's that whole thing look like for you and in your success of this?
Terrifying. Cause I'm an introvert by nature and public speaking is, you know, like that is the last thing that I would have said I would do in my life. I probably pick dates instead of be a public speaker because I mean, I'll give you an example. After I played soccer in college, I went back and became a high school soccer coach for my high school for about 4 to 6 years, something like that. And the most dreadful thing to me was the coaches' parents meetings where we would go to the school library and we would be in a room with maybe 30 parents and I would have to speak to the parents. It was terrifying. I would literally shake and I don't know what that fear was of me just talking about, you know, hey, we need vans for, you know, to take the kids to the games. Hey, you know, we need to fundraise them. It was nothing, you know, that would should create anxiety, but it created a lot of anxiety. And I remember when I started doing this, I went because at that. So one of the things is, I don't know about every industry, but at least the industry that I'm in, a lot of brands are looking at social media. At the time, they were looking at YouTube for people. Now, for a fact, I know, because I'm friends with some of the people that are doing the searching, they're searching for people on TikTok. So if you're a graphic artist, anything with graphics or video, they're looking at TikTok for creators to kind of bring on to promote their brands. But anyway, at the time, they were looking at YouTube. And somehow I made it into this woman's radar. And she worked for Adobe and messaged me and said, hey, I see that you live in San Francisco. Do you want to come in and do portfolio reviews for students at a conference called the 3% conference? I believe the name of the conference was. And this is a conference for trying to get young women into the creative industry. When this conference started, from my understanding, the creative industry was only made up of 3% women. Now the number's much higher, but the name still remains. The point is that I went and did portfolio reviews and I was sitting there and a woman sitting across from me said, hey, do you know what the Wi-Fi password is? And I was like, sure, this is the Wi-Fi password. And we became friends. And it turned out that she, her name was Sally Cox, and Sally ran a user group at Adobe headquarter in San Jose. And what that means is she didn't work for Adobe, but she just used their offices to bring in people and bring in a guest speaker and show how to use the product. So Adobe liked it because, you know, they brought people into the office and showcase the products with local artists. So she invited me to do that. It was not paid, but I was going to speak in front of about 100 people. And to this day, I haven't prepared as hard as I did for that presentation. But one of the mental things that happened is because I was terrified. And I remember I was driving and I was stuck in traffic. I mean, you know, Bay Area traffic. I was, you know, on the 880 in that parking lot. It's known as the 880 and
the Bay Bridge.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, all right, do you want to do this or do you not want to do this? And I was like, I do want to do this. All right, then why are you scared? Like, stop being scared. And like, wasn't scared anymore. Now, that's to this day, I still get nervous before I go on, but I'm no longer scared. I still want to do it. I just have those butterflies of like, oh, I want to do good. You know what I mean? It's different than it's not anxiety. It's not like, no, I just mentally talk myself out of being scared. But the point is that was very helpful for me because not only did I get to go into the Adobe building and make some Adobe contacts there, but since we were doing the event at the main Adobe conference room, there's like a giant Adobe logo in the background. And then there's like I had about 100 people in this room. So they got really good photos of me. So I'm standing there pointing my hand and I'm like Steve Jobs, you know, just doing the whole thing. And to this day, you'll find those photos on my website because they're really good photos. But that was my first speaking engagement and meeting people there. And also me realizing these photos are going to come in handy because I look so professional. that I'm going to just blast it all over my website. So when somebody goes to my about page, they'll see those photos. And I don't know how much that played a part in me getting other speaking gigs. I'm talking specifically about the photos, but I've had comments from people that invited me to speaking events saying, oh, we thought you've been a speaker forever because we went to your website and we saw those great photos at Adobe. Little did they know that that was like a free event. And, you know, it was just a user group, like not a big thing. There's user groups all over the country, and most of them are done like in basements and libraries or whatever. But I was lucky enough that my user group, my local user group, just happened to be at Adobe HQ, and it just made it look, it made it look and feel much bigger than it was. And perception is reality. And a lot of people perceived it that I was doing like big events when I really wasn't. I also had the fortune of living in the Bay Area where I was talented enough that I was in their Rolodex. And if somebody dropped out or somebody needed anything, I was close enough that they didn't need to fly me in. And that was a huge advantage. So I started getting speaking engagements that way. And I always done well. I've always done really well in my speaking engagements. So once I do one, I usually get invited back over and over and over again until I say no. But, you know, it was fortunate that I was at the right place at the right time, and I was prepared to do it too.
That's awesome. So now you're starting to hit critical mass here. You know, you got your YouTube channel, you're doing work, you're speaking engagements. You're starting to see like, you know, inertia behind all your efforts, right? And I want to jump forward to a situation because I think it's just so interesting the fact that, you know, this situation that we talked to in the pregame.
Yeah.
But you're kind of like, you know, that's not on your radar. You're like, yeah, things are doing great. How the hell, what the fuck happened here? You know, this doesn't fit.
Yeah.
So kind of like tell us the story leading into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So everyone in my family lives to be in their 90s, some people close to 100. And I thought to myself, I'm going to live forever. Like I've always been athletic. I've always watched what I eat. You know, every doctor's appointment, they're like, you're super healthy. Like you don't need to worry about anything. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm living forever. Like my grandpa who drank, never ate right, never exercised, lived to be to his late 90s, you know? Mm. So good stock, good genes. And that was my mentality. And not to say that I was reckless or anything, but September of 2021, I started just getting a lot of neck pain. And I thought, oh, well, I think I just, you know, work in a computer all day and I'm probably not exercising as much as I should be, or, you know, I slept wrong or something, but I just had a lot of neck pain. I play soccer every Tuesday night and I was playing soccer and I started feeling, we're actually playing our championship game. And I remember the game was almost over. We were winning and I had a good game. I think we were winning 3-2 and I scored 2 goals. So I was physically feeling great. And then all of a sudden I started getting a little dizzy and I'm like, okay, that's weird. Like, why am I dizzy? And next thing you know, I just feel like the world is spinning. Like I've never felt such vertigo in my life. And it wasn't painful, but it was like the worst feeling I've ever had. And I knew that if I didn't drop, I would collapse. So I grabbed my head and I just dropped to the ground. And then people ran to me and asked me what was wrong. And I said, I don't know, but you got to take me to a hospital. Because I knew that something was not right. A friend of mine, Mara, and another friend of mine, Taylor, put me in their car and drove me to the hospital, which thankfully was a short drive. If anybody knows Oakland, I went to the Oakland Kaiser on Piedmont, and within 15 to 20 minutes of collapsing, I had medical attention. And what happened when I woke up the next day is they told me that I had suffered a stroke. I had a cervical dissection. So I had a neck injury. To this day, I don't know how the neck injury happened. Doctors say it could have been from playing sports. It could have been from turning my head too fast when somebody called my name. Who knows? But the point is that the artery that connects my neck to my brain had an injury. In an attempt to heal itself, it created a blood clot that became dislodged and went into my brain. So that's how the stroke happened. So my cerebellum was affected the most in the parts that control motor skills. So the next day when I woke up, the room was spinning. And I had a neurologist come in and say that, you know, he sat next to me in the bed and put his hand on my thigh. And he said, you got to come to terms with the fact that you're going to be disabled. And I was so angry, not at him, at the situation. And in my mind, I said, this is not going to work out. Like, no. So when everybody left the room, I held myself by the side of the bed because I couldn't stand on my own. Mm. And you got to think of that psychological process where, like, just less than 24 hours ago, I was running around playing soccer and now I can't even stand up, you know? So like I stood up and I could still, you know, like move my feet a little bit, but I started doing like little baby calf raises. And I was like, I'm starting my PT right now. Yeah. The next day I talked to and I cannot remember exactly her title, but it was some sort of therapist that was evaluating me. And she said something that I took to heart, which was, you know your body, try to push as much as you can. Don't let anyone slow you down. Doctors may be a little too cautious, but you know your body. So if you think you can do something, do it and push yourself. And what I was told was, I'm going to need to relearn how to do a lot of things. Like one of my exercises was actually like laying on the floor and rolling over like a baby because I couldn't roll over, you know? So, you know, I'm going to skip through a lot, but what I was living alone at the time. My mom, who lives in San Leandro, which is where you used to live, Michael, moved in with me for a couple months because I couldn't walk. I lived in a two-story place. So she was helping me with, you know, food and, you know, just basic stuff. But I was with a walker, and a funny story. I had just started dating my current girlfriend, and she actually met my parents at the hospital. So that's a hell of a way to meet your new partner's parents. But the point is that I became obsessed with getting better. I was told wherever you are at the 6 month mark, that's what you'll probably be for the rest of your life. So in my mind, I was like, all right, I got 6 months to really, really push as far as I can go. And my obsession became recovery. My obsession used to be work. It used to be trying to figure out how to get people to click on a freaking YouTube video, right? And I was very fortunate that I had the means to not work for several months and focus on that. And I realized that's a huge blessing that other people may not have in my situation. So I do recognize, you know, that fortunate spot that I was in. But I started by just you know, walking with a walker, walking with a cane eventually, and eventually walking without any assistance. And I used to take my mom on we would walk 3 miles down this trail behind my place and then 3 miles back, 6 miles round trip. And then I would go to the gym and you know, do weights and you know, my athlete mentality came back because, you know, we started this conversation with me being a bad student. I don't read anything, you know, like people talk about books. I was like, I never read anything. And I feel bad because I wish I would know some of the classics, but I'm not a reader. The point is that I got this packet from my physical therapist and I was, you know what? I don't need to read this. I'm going to look at the pictures. I've been exercising my entire life. I know how to exercise. So there is this exercise that I thought was okay. You do a one-legged squat. I was like, yeah, I've done one-legged squats, you know, millions of times. Like, this is no problem. And in that state, it's impossible to do a one-legged squat. And I was like, oh my God, this is so, so difficult. Like, why would they assign this? And then I started thinking, old people get these types of, you know, issues. How are they doing these exercises? And then I finally managed to do a one-legged squat. And I was talking to I went back for a checkup and I was talking to my physical therapist and I was telling her, hey, you know, like I'm doing really good. I can finally do a one-legged squat. I'm like about 2 right now. And she's like, what are you talking about? I was like, that right there. And then I showed her on the paper and she's like, no, that's not a one-legged squat. That's you standing and you lift your leg up. You know what I mean? Like you kind of put your heel to your butt.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I thought that was a one-legged squat. So like I was like doing a lot more than I, you know, they wanted.
I think everybody should do one-legged squats.
100%.
That's good. It sounds. I'm gonna add that to my curriculum. So you were doing these. You know. So you were ahead of the game.
100%. I mean, I wanted to. So I don't recall the metrics that they used, but every time I would go into my physical therapist's office, she would write things down and then she would give me like a numeric value and you know, like this is like a 2 or a 3 or whatever, you know. And my goal was to get a perfect score, and I never did it, but I wanted to get a perfect. I asked her, like, all right, what's the score? Like, and she was like, well, in the way we're counting here, a perfect score will be this number. And again, I forget the how they evaluated everything. And I was like, well, that's my goal. I want a perfect score. But unfortunately, I didn't get a perfect score because the issue that I was having most trouble with is closing my eyes and walking straight. I would veer to one side. And as much as I try to force my body to like stay super center, I couldn't do it. But it's just funny how, you know, things that you would imagine are so easy become so difficult once you've had a stroke, you know?
Right. So it's been now in the pregame, you told me you're at like 99%.
Yeah. I mean, it's so weird to think about. It's even telling the story now, like it doesn't feel like it happened to me. You know, it feels like I'm telling you a story that happened to a friend. I do obviously remember the feelings and the fear of like, oh my God, like, cause so many days I thought, you know, what if this is it? Like, what if this feeling I have right now is it? What if I never lose this cane? It's always there. But then at the same time, that other part of me is like, no, we're going to work. We're going to work at it. Let's just do it. Like, let's not think about that. But you can't help to start thinking that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But looking back at it, it's so weird because like I'm playing soccer again. The only thing I can do, according to my neurologist, and I am going to listen, is I can't use my head while playing soccer, which makes a lot of sense.
You don't want to bang your head against the ball. You know,
Yeah. But besides that, I mean, there's a couple of things like, you know, I'm not supposed to do. I can't, you know, head the ball. I can't, you know, pick up boxing, which, you know, it's not something right. I was planning to do anyway. Anything that hurts my head or you know, jerks my neck around, I can't do. I take a pill every day. But besides that, I feel pretty normal. My stroke happened because of an injury, not because of biology. So theoretically, once my neck healed, I'm good. The only thing I had to worry was about the damage that was caused to my cerebellum. And it's still there. Like I've seen the MRIs and x-rays and all that. And I can see the part of my brain that died that will no longer come back. You know, when this type of stuff happens to someone, you know, it is critical that you get medical attention as soon as possible, because what you lose, you really can't get back. You can only try to relearn some things and hopefully your body adapts to its new normal. But, you know, like when you lose part of your brain, you just don't get it back. Right. So I was very fortunate again that I was close to a hospital. I got medical attention right away. And you know, who knows what the extent of the stroke would have been if that wasn't the case. But, you know, I'm glad that I don't have to ever figure that out or find that out.
Have you talked about this in your talks when you do a talk now?
Well, a little bit. So my very first conference where I talked about it just happened in October of this year, Adobe Max, literally a year after my stroke. It was so funny because of COVID in 2021, so Adobe Max, for those of you that don't know, is the largest creative conference for Adobe. It's almost like, you know, when Apple does that giant event and they reveal the new iPhone and all that. So Adobe does the same thing. And that's when the new Photoshop comes out, the new Adobe Illustrator, all their creative applications come out. It's a big event. Prior to the pandemic, it used to be about a 17,000 person event. This year was in person again, and it was half that size now. But the point is that during the pandemic, they went into an online only event. So my stroke happened 2 weeks prior to that event. And I told the one piece of work that I did do was I told Adobe, like, hey, I don't want to miss the event. I'll do it. And they're like, you can't do it. You just had a stroke. It's like, no, I'm fine. Look, I can sit down and you know, like I could, you know, like I'm not going to run or jump, you know, like I'm fine. And so it was only a 25 minute little baby thing. Anyway, they were reluctant and I'm sure they had plan Bs in case I collapsed on camera,
right.
But I did it. So I mentioned a little bit about it then, but in Adobe Max came back to an in-person event this year. So during my initial presentation, when I was introducing myself, I did mention my stroke. I talked about what happened, where I was. I showed pictures of my MRIs, x-rays, and all that. And I mentioned to them that one of my goals was to come back and do that Adobe Max event, quote unquote, normal. Like in my mind is, I want to come back and be a speaker at this event, but I don't want to come back in a wheelchair or in a walk. Like I want to be able to do it normal. So like that was one of my goals when I was, you know, I want to get back to that. And you know, thankfully that's what happened. And and I didn't go into too much detail, but I did tell people, hey, I just want to let you know this happened. I'm here and I feel like I, you know, I accomplished the goal of being back to quote unquote normal at this event.
Yeah. So where, you know, when you think of all this stuff, you know, I mean, where do you grow? I mean, cause now you've accomplished, you know, quite a bit, you in your career, what you felt a stride, you know, you feel great. You had this obstacle. But when you think about the big picture, you know, the broad scope of where you want to go, what does that look like for you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot, right? Like, I do have a goal of continuing to grow my YouTube channel. I do have a goal of continuing to branch out to other events that I've never been a speaker of. I've been a speaker at 35 conferences, but I want to branch out to new conferences that I've never spoken at. Most of my events have been demonstrations, so me showing how to use the tool. I've only done two TED Talk style events where there's no computer in front of me, and those are extremely scary because I do, you know, hide behind a screen and I'm very good at it. So then, you know, like anything else just goes out the window if people are focused on my work. But I also, I mean, to be completely open here with you, Michael, one of the reasons that I on the show is because I want to start a podcast, and I thought,
well, you don't do one yet. You don't do one already.
I don't do one already.
Look at you, got this great Rode mic and everything. Well, I mean, got this beautiful backdrop.
Yeah, this is all YouTube.
Nice.
But then I thought, I don't know anything about, I've been a guest on a few podcasts here and there, you know, maybe like total of like four throughout, you know, the 10 years I've been doing this. But I thought, what I need to do is I need to get comfortable on being on the microphone, comfortable on, you know, like doing what a podcast is. And I did some research. To be open with you, the podcast that I already have a name, it's called Today's Creator. And I want to interview creators, people who create for a living, you know, artists, graphic designers, photographers, musicians. If you make a living in the creative industry, that's, I want to talk to you, because I realize that there's a lot of misconceptions, and people always think of like, the one of the reasons that I came up with that idea is through my stroke, a very good friend of mine, her name is Lisa Carney. I'm 100% sure everybody listening has seen her work. She has been in the movie industry for about 30 years, and pretty much any big poster that you've seen, she did. I mean, if you've seen Spider-Man Far From Home, that was her posters, you know. So she does work for, you know, everybody. But she and I became good friends through a conference. And she reached out when I had my stroke, sent the care package, was constantly checking up on me, like wonderful, wonderful friend. And she said, hey, you know, like, do you need any money? Like, if you need money, let me know. And I was like, no, you don't have to worry about money, but I appreciate it. And she was like, okay. She was like, yeah, because if you needed money, I was just going to offer you some work. And I was like, oh, like, I know what kind of work you do. Are you talking about like movie posters? And it's like, yeah. And I was like, well, I'll take the work, not because I need the money, but because it's always been a thing I wanted to do. I wanted to create movie posters, because as a kid, that's what I, you know, I would look at movie posters and recreate them. Side story, I was in college and we had a family computer in the living room, and I was in the family computer in the living room and I was messing around doing something. One of my mom's friends comes over to the house, and my backdrop at the time, my wallpaper was the movie poster for Spider-Man 2 with Tobey Maguire. And I overheard my mom's friend point at the picture and say something like, oh, like, what is that? And then my mom said, oh, I don't know. I think, you know, Jesus made it. And then she said, oh, no, he can't do that. No, that's too good. He's not that good. And that pissed me off so much that, like, even to this day, like, I was like, I need to make a goddamn movie poster, yes. You know? So when that opportunity came, I was like, yeah, I'm not going to do it for the money, but I'm going to do it because I really, really want to do it. And that's the thing. I'm in the fortunate position that I can pick the projects I work on. Like, I didn't have to take a project just because I needed to make a few dollars. I took the project because it's what I wanted to do. And it's, I'm not going to lie, it's well paid. And it's fun work for me. It's not easy. And there's, you know, like any other job, there's drawbacks and, you know, you late nights or whatever, things that, you know, maybe I wouldn't want to do for other things, but since it was something I wanted to do, I started to do. To answer your question, what do I do want to, you know, do now? I want to keep growing the YouTube channel. I want to keep doing training. I want to keep doing conferences. And now I want to keep doing posters. Again, not necessarily for the money, but because I really enjoy it. It helps me flex a muscle that I don't often flex with the other things. And I also think it helps bring some credibility to my training. I know a lot of career trainers, nothing wrong with that. But I've literally known people who do what I do, who probably are more successful than me, that they literally graduated from college and jumped onto training. And they've been training for who knows how many years. And I, again, nothing wrong with that. And there's a lot of people who do that, that I highly respect and who I think are wonderful. But I wanted to come in a position where I'm like, not only am I training, but I'm actually doing like really legit high level work, you know? So I think that also helps me stand apart from other people who do what I do, because very few people are doing both the training and high level work. And that's where I want to be.
Right. You know, I wanted to, you know, I like to, you know, tailor off on, you know, your story that you basically encapsulated for us was, you know, your stroke is just, you know, is a big part of you now, you know, and it's a great part of your story. But I would like to give our audience, you know, maybe like a couple bullet points. It seems silly, but I was going to say, nah, should I end it right there? Because it's such a great story. You had a big challenge and you overcame it. But we have to ask, you know, it's new year. And I just want to, you know, ask you a couple of these bullet points.
Let's do it.
A website, poster, you know, what are some of the key components, or like, you know, copy for a product, you know, people out there with a business are like, what, when you look at it and you say, look, what's really going to catch the eye of a buyer, somebody that wants to buy the product, buy the service, what are some of the key little nuggets that you are cognitive of when you're designing something? What should everybody kind of gravitate towards?
Well, first of all, you need to know who your audience is. I think that's the most important thing. Who's going to buy your product? Who's going to pay for your service? And then you have to speak to that person. And I know that's like super generic, but how do you do that? Well, since I'm a graphics person, we'll start there and then we can talk about copywriting if you like. But if, like, I was just looking at, I just moved to the area where I live at now. I live south of San Jose and California. And I've been looking at a lot of local businesses because now I got to find where's my local fridge repair man or whatever. So I've been looking at a lot of local businesses. And one of the things that I see is I think that a lot of people are talking to everyone, but at the same time, not talking to anyone. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate going to looking for a service and they do everything and have to read through, you know, blocks and blocks and blocks of copy. The photos really don't show me anything. If anything, they show me that I can't trust them as a business owner. And what I mean by that is, so again, I'm gonna quote my mentor Ben. One time, Ben and I went to an Italian restaurant, and he started saying, "I love this place. This is one of the best local Italian restaurants in Danville, California. Forget the name, but he's like, look at that corner. There's webs on that on the wall." And he goes, "Oh, look at the side there on the wall. There, it's chipped." And, you know, he started pointing all these little things out that had nothing to do with the food. He hit one of his favorite restaurants and he said, "The only reason I come here is because I know the food is good. But if I just walked in, never had seen not knowing anything about this restaurant, I wouldn't eat here. Because if they can't take the time to take those webs off the wall, then what guarantees do I have that the food's going to be good?" And that's what I think about when I think about, if I were to give advice on somebody on how to design how to present their product or their service, is that you have to look at the little things. Like, I think that a lot of people, and it's fair, nobody has, you know, first of all, not everybody has a design degree. Second of all, nobody, you know, not a lot of people know how to use the tools. Not a lot of people have the budget to hire people. So I understand that a lot of these things take either knowledge or money or both. But like, for example, if you look at a local business, a lot of times on their Facebook page, Yelp page, the photos that they have, they're very low quality. You know, sometimes it's better to just maybe have one or two high quality photos than 20 photos that are terrible. Mm. You know, so in these days with an iPhone, Android, whatever, you can get good quality photos. It just takes a little bit of time. if you have the budget, hire somebody to come in and take photos of your business. Also, something I see people do this often on YouTube, and this is general, not just YouTube. We have to think that we're primarily a mobile first society now, whether we like it or not. I personally don't, but that's the world we live in. So most people are going to look at your marketing material through a phone. Odds are. What a lot of people do, especially on YouTube thumbnails, that I don't think is good, is they'll put in a paragraph of text over a photo. Where in my opinion, that shouldn't be the case. It should just be attention grabbing words, you know? So whatever three or four words could really capture the person that you're trying to get should be on that photo and nothing else. Like, you don't need to put in your phone number and all this other stuff, because first of all, it's really hard to see. And then now you have people pinching in and zooming, and they might not even see it then. So it just needs to be clean, clear, and to the point. We talked about my YouTube videos, how I now start super clean and super concise. The same mentality goes, in my opinion, to the content, the marketing content that you created should be clear, to the point, no nonsense. And quality is perception, I think. So you don't need to hire a fancy designer. You don't need to have, you know, the most well-designed things. But like I said, a well-taken photo, you know, that alone talks about quality. And it might not necessarily be the quality in terms of like, oh, we brought in a lighting setup and, you know, we, you know, it talks more about like, this person took the time and care to take a good photo than just like a crappy photo from like 2002, you know? So that's the advice that I would give. Try to package your services better just by taking better photos, by look, something that I do with my YouTube thumbnails, actually, and this could apply to anything, is I look at them on my phone. Because if I can't see them on my phone, or they don't look good on my phone, then they're not going to go up, you know? Because again, I know this is very specific to YouTube, but I think that the idea behind it could be applied to other things, because a lot of times we're so busy, you know, we got, you know, work, family, kids, whatever. And I just did this thumbnail. I just did this ad. I just did whatever, but it looks a little crappy on my phone, but screw it. I have no more time. It's just going to go out. Like, I know that a lot of times that might take more time, but I redo it. Why? Because if that gives me a 2-5% increase in clicks or, you know, whatever, that also means that I get more revenue, you know, either through AdSense, either through, you know, and like, I just have this mentality that if you add a little, you know, 1% here, 2% there, 5% here, in terms of the ROI that you get on that input, it'll add up to a lot. Even though like somebody might say, oh, who cares? It's just one thumbnail. Like, it doesn't matter, you know? But no, but it does matter, you know, ultimately. It doesn't matter on that specific video. But if you treat everything that way, then it does matter. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And those are such valid points. And for anybody that's, you know, has a website for a product or a service, and it's a small business or even a big business, you know, and you're thinking about doing that, all these are just major points, you know. Don't have the knee-jerk reaction to just say, well, we got to put something in there. You know, really take the time, because, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest link, which if we want to bookend this, that comes down to what really made you successful and why you have that YouTube trophy right there to the right of your side or your left, whatever, you know, is that,
yes.
Yeah. So it's because you chose to not have many weak links and to take time to do the quality. And I think that, you know, it used to be like, you know, maybe there are certain things where, you know, maybe, you know, repetition is more important than quality sometimes.
Yes.
But I don't know, man, I think it just makes perfect sense to me. So, thank you for sharing everything. I mean, I really love your story. I love how, you know, you made lemonade, didn't you? You know, you just, the way, you know, I just love it. Please tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
Yeah, definitely. Photoshop Training Channel is the YouTube, the website, the Instagram, everything. PhotoshopTrainingChannel.com. And, you know, I got nothing to sell unless you want to learn some Photoshop, then you can check it out. So I'm not here to promote, you know, like get a million subscribers in a month course or anything like that. So if you want to learn Photoshop, check out the YouTube channel.
You know, I haven't checked it out, you know, your YouTube channel really in depth, but I will tell you, you're successful most likely because You're natural, you're honest, you're transparent, which makes you very likable. And I like Jesus Ramirez, so I'm going to put my vote in there for that. Thank you so much for sharing today.
Thank you so much.
That was YouTube influencer, graphics designer extraordinaire, public speaker, and stroke recoverer, Jesus Ramirez. Here's a great quote for Jesus. "We have to go through the tumbler a few times before we can emerge as a crystal." Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right, have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right, thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.